Hey, do us a favor. If you like listening to the show, please just take a few minutes, not even a few minutes, 1 minute, to go into Apple Podcasts and rate and review the show.
This is Random Badass Review.
You've done this before. You're an age professional now.
This is only my second podcast, so let's see how I do.
I was listening to something the other day, and I hate this. I do this all the time on this podcast, but I listen to so many things while I'm, you know, like doing other activities. I'm listening to podcasts or something, and half the times things just kind of float into my head.
Yeah,
and then I don't remember what I was listening to that the idea came from. But it was an interview with somebody, and they were talking about this band that I had never heard of. And I guess, I don't know if it was a local band or something, but they used the phrase, they released 1,000 albums. And I think it's probably an exaggeration of some degree. But the point that this guy was making was that they released a huge number of albums. They were always putting out albums, and some of them...
Was it Guided by Voices?
No, they definitely do that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I love those guys. No, this is a band I'd never even heard of. So it was like Sun City something. But the person being interviewed in the podcast I was listening to talked to the, I assume, like the singer or the main songwriter of that band and said, you know, man, you guys put out so much stuff. And he's like, yeah. He's like, some of it's great. He's like, some of it's horseshit. Some of it's complete garbage. He's like, but the process is the work. It's the putting the thing out.
Yeah. He's like,
and I thought about that because I had been just talking to a friend, Brandon, who was on the show before, and he was kind of a little bit bummed about the sound quality of his end of the conversation because he didn't have time to like get a professional microphone or anything like that for the interview. And I told him, you know, like podcasting is not an audiophile form. You know, it's just not, people don't come here expecting perfection from a podcast. It's more akin to the guy dropping albums. It's like, you just put out the episodes, you know, and they are what they are. Sometimes the sound quality is somebody has a cell phone like you do. Sometimes somebody has a, you know, $5,000 microphone, whatever. That's the circumstance of the episode. It's not the important part.
Yeah. Most of the podcasts I listen to are exactly that. Somebody will sound very good. Obviously the host and then the person that they're speaking to, sometimes they'll be, you know, they'll be there with them. Or sometimes they'll be calling in, and this is exactly what it sounds like. And I listened to that interview too, and he sounded like the audio quality was like almost like any other podcast I listened to.
Right,
he sounded fine.
Like Tim Ferriss. You listen, Tim Ferriss is like one of the top podcasts in the world, and sometimes his, you know, the other end of the his end always sounds the same, but the other end sometimes sounds like garbage.
Yeah,
and it's you know, when you're talking to people, it's not only just an equipment thing, you know, sometimes, like, especially for him, he's talking to people that are super, super busy. I was like, oh, sure, I could get into a studio or I could talk to you on the phone. I'm more likely to have this conversation with you if you can talk to me on the phone. So he just goes for that. And I'm like, why not? The conversation, that's what matters, at least for me.
Yeah.
Even NPR, they have... You remember like before like podcasts, before most of us knew what podcasts were and we listened to NPR on the radio, how many of those things were like shitty phone calls with like, and not even like cell phone quality, like landline crappy quality phone calls?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, so many of them. And again, even podcasts now are, the sound quality is not particularly great with the guest. And that's fine. If you know, I'm not listening to a podcast and I'm not listening to an interview for the sound quality. And now, no, don't get me wrong. I've listened to some podcasts where the host sounds bad. That'll turn me off. If the host sounds terrible, then, you know, if I have to increase the volume exponentially just to listen to the host, then I'm out. I can't listen to that anymore.
Yeah, if you can't control your end of the conversation and keep it clean, then unless, you know, you're just a beginner, that's fine if you're a beginner. Like, I know that when Lam and I first started doing this podcast, I think it was like 3 years ago, we recorded on the earbuds that came with our iPhones.
Oh, sure. Yeah, just starting out, you know.
But then as I've gone along, I've progressed. Like now I have the same microphone that Rogan has, which is like a $400 microphone. But I had to invest 3 years to realize that, okay, now is the time that it's worth that investment. If I had bought this right at the beginning, I'd be an idiot. Just plain and simple.
Do you and Lam, are you guys together when you do the podcast at times, or is it always over the phone or computer?
Always exactly the way you and I are doing it right now, over Zoom.
Okay, because sometimes I can't tell because he sounds super clear on his end.
Yeah, he has a good microphone now.
Yeah.
What's funny is the microphone that he has, I say it's a good microphone. It is a good microphone. It's only a $60 microphone. That's the thing that's amazing about audio equipment. I mean, like the one, like I said, the Shure that I have right now is a $400 mic. It's pretty much the best mic you can get. It's the same microphone that Michael Jackson used to record all of Thriller, but it's only $400. That's not that expensive for like top of the line. That's not outrageous. You know, other fields, you know, you get into thousands when you get to the top of things.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I know with photography, I mean, you get into, that's an expensive hobby.
Oh, yeah. Photography is easy. Right? You're like, you get on camera. Okay. No, this one's $500. Okay.
Yeah.
What's the next one?
I've slowed down for sure on what I've spent on photography. I mean, quite a bit. I still only have the three lenses that I've been shooting on for years. I actually did buy the last year. I started to get interested. I'd always liked the images, but I started to get interested in macro photography.
Mm-hmm.
And Best Buy had a pretty good deal on a Canon macro lens. So I went and bought it, and I maybe had it for maybe 2 days tops. And I returned it because I thought to myself, I don't need this right now. I don't need it. And I don't think that I'm going to spend the time, to learn how to use it and to learn how to use it properly to at least warrant the purchase. And, so I returned it. I'm like, you know what? I've done fine with the three lenses I have. That's kind of my wheelhouse, and macro photography is not something that I need to get into at the moment. I'll learn it later.
I think there's this like obsession with tools. Everybody gets obsessed with tools. You know, like I know like when I first started doing the vlogging thing, which I did a couple years ago and then stopped after 200 days, completely burned out. When I first started, I'm like, I got to know what is the right equipment, you know? And it was, and I kept reading these things by people who were vlogging or making videos, not necessarily movies, but you know, like YouTube, high quality YouTube videos. And they would always get asked that question, and their answer would be like, you know, the equipment doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And I always thought that was such bullshit. But then the more you get into it, it's kind of a mix of both, right? Like you need decent equipment. You don't want to have garbage equipment, but you don't need top of the line unless you know that, like you said, that the benefit matches the cost. If I'm going to spend $500 on this thing, am I going to get $500 of use out of this? You know, am I going to use it for $500 worth? No, then that's a waste of money.
Yeah. And that's exactly why I returned it. And my wife, Josephine, she was like, okay, so you got a new lens. What do you, you know, so you're going to get into macro photography now. And I said, sure. And I went out, went to the park and just shot a bunch of things. And the pictures were terrible. And not that I thought that the pictures, because I, consider myself a fairly good photographer. Not that I thought the pictures were going to look great, but I'm like, I know nothing about macro photography. And, and honestly, like, what was I thinking? Like, I'm not going to learn how to use this thing right now. I'm not going to be able to. When I got into photography, it was before we had kids. So I got into it at a really good time in my life. Where, not that this is not a really good time in my life. I just mean I got into it when I had the time to just sit on the couch and read and just absorb and actually just take off for a couple of hours and shoot and practice.
Right.
And I had that time, so I learned quite a bit during that time. And I still learned, like when I had kids, I definitely learned more on how to shoot children. That's for sure. and even action photography when I started shooting my son's games and all that stuff. But I was like, no, I'm not gonna learn how to choose macro photography. But I think for some people, and not everybody, but I think for some people, it adds, like, having all this equipment adds a certain legitimacy to the thing. And it's not right. The case. I mean, it really isn't. And, you know, I've been shooting on the same Canon 7D for, God, close to 10 years now. And that would be my next logical investment, would be a body, because the lenses I have are still really good lenses, and I know how to use them well. A body is maybe something that I might consider, but even that might be another year or two down the line, because the 7D that I have does exactly what I want it to at the moment. So.
Right. Like I don't do as much photography as you do, but like I still have a Sony NEX7 that I bought, like, I don't know, like 7, 8, maybe 9 years ago.
Is that what you're using for the vlogs?
No, I was using a Canon, what the heck, that little tiny handheld one. Yeah, this one was, the problem with the Sony is they don't make Sonys with the front flip, you know, where you can see the screen, so you can see what you're doing. Yeah. So for vlogging, that was awful. But I wish I could have used that one, because I don't know what it is, those first Sony NEX cameras, even though they don't have huge megapixels, it doesn't matter, because the glass on them was really good, and they work great. Like, I love it. I still, like, I haven't felt a need to buy another camera. You know, I bought the other one for vlogging because that was for video, and I don't like using that camera for taking photos. I don't like the way they look. They look kind of fuzzy to me.
Yeah, and that's even the thing about the megapixels too, the misconception that more megapixels is, you know, is just the end all. And no, it's not. Right. It's really how you use the camera. Exactly that. And I don't shoot anything that I'm blowing up to, you know, fit a billboard. So, you know, I'm shooting maybe at most, I think 16 by 20 is the most I've ever blown a photo up. And it looks good. You know, at least I do. I think it looks fine.
Yeah, you don't need very many megapixels to do that at all. Like, I think 40 would do it.
Yeah. Actually, my first, it's funny you mentioned Sony. That was actually my first SLR. I started on a Canon point-and-shoot, and then when I started getting interested in it, and I'm glad that I got interested in it on a point-and-shoot, you know, and I started messing around with all the settings, and once I kind of... at least my skill level kind of surpassed what that camera was able to do. I was like, all right, well, maybe I'll look into my first SLR. So I bought this, the A200, the Sony A200, and it was an introductory model. And I bought it with the whole package, you know, with the wide lens and the zoom lens that it came with. And shot on that thing for a few years and loved it. Learned a lot on that before I upgraded. And
yeah, I definitely prefer Canon because their color profile, I think, is better. Sony is too saturated for me.
Yeah. I have a buddy who started with Canon, moved to Nikon, then went back to Canon. Actually, no, I'm sorry. He went to Canon, went to Nikon, went to Sony, and has stayed with Sony ever since. He uses one of those high-end mirrorless Sony cameras that look really good. I mean, his pictures definitely look like you said. I mean, they're a bit more saturated.
Yeah.
It's a good camera. It is. And I don't have anything. So I moved.
You can't really. I think as far as like the mechanics of it, I think they make the best mechanics probably.
Yeah. Yeah. And they didn't have the lens lineup at the time. I thought, you know, well, if I want to expand a bit more, lens wise, you know, Sony didn't necessarily have the lens lineup that Canon did. So that's the only reason why I went Canon. And also because I wanted something rugged. And, you know, the A200 I had was a piece of plastic. I mean, it was a good camera, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I wanted something a bit more rugged. The 7D has a magnesium alloy body and shot and was really fast, you know, at the time. I mean, they make faster cameras, obviously. But that was, I think, 8 frames per second, which was awesome. But,
well, you know, speaking of photography, why don't you have an Instagram? I feel you have a photography Instagram by now, man.
I have definitely I've been considering that over the past couple of years, and you're not the first person to ask me that. And it would make sense, absolutely, for me to have
one. It seems
one,
like so your I'm format.
yeah, it really is. I mean, I like Facebook. I like Twitter. And having a third social media account, I think that's really the only, that's really the thing that's kept me from it, even though mm-hmm. I probably would have a lot of fun with it and, you know, be able to follow a lot of artists and photographers. And, you know, I use Facebook for a very specific reason. I use Twitter for a very specific reason. And I feel I would use Instagram for an even more specific reason. Mm-hmm. But, I think just because I think it's just a social media demo. Do I really need another social media account?
Well, I can tell you that you can use it differently than everybody else. That's what I try to do with all the accounts is I don't get into the social shit anymore. I don't have a personal one anymore. I've got one for the podcast and I've got one for my dog. And I made the one for my dog right. just so that the podcast people wouldn't be inundated with pictures of my dog.
Right.
I don't do all the chatty shit in the comments and all that underneath. I just post stuff. I look at a few things and then I'm out. And I just think it's kind of, I hate the fact that Facebook owns Instagram, but it is kind of at the point where being a photographer and not having Instagram kind of looks strange almost. Like, oh, it's sad to say. I'm not saying that as I'm proud of that being a fact, but it does kind of seem that way. It's strange.
It's fair. It's fair. And it's a fair question too. And I don't, other than that, I don't really have another answer because it does, it would make sense for me to have an Instagram account. And who knows, I probably will. You know, every time I'm on Facebook, there's always that, you know, all of these friends you know are using Instagram. Use Instagram. And I'm mm-hmm. like, no, not yet, you know.
Well, you know, the reason I bring it up is selfish is just because I want to see your damn pictures.
Oh, thank you.
And you know what?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I don't share, I share photos here and there on Facebook. You know, I'll share them of, you know, trips we take or of my son, but I try not to share too many photos. At least I try and be somewhat selective on the photos I share on Facebook.
Yeah, you don't want to block out people's political rants with actual.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I definitely don't want to. You know,
don't wanna I want to.
Yeah, you know, I want to see your Trump post. You know,
not pictures of your kids. We just want to hear people angry about something that they don't even read.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I want to know how you'll fix the country. But, yeah, I mean that's unfair. I mean I use Facebook to I make jokes about Trump too, so I'm in that. I don't think I do it as fervently as others, but you know I do it.
Yeah, it's hard to get wrapped up in that without it, like you know, like whatever, you know, whether people like him or don't like him, and they get putting up angry posts either way.
It is, yeah, and people
literally.
Yeah, and people can use, honestly, I don't give a shit. I mean, use your social media the way you want to use your social media, and your friends right. will either choose to follow you or not. But I do, like, I'm more forgiving of political rants on Twitter because I think it's more designed as a platform in that regard, you know, for you to just, you know, pop off on whatever issue, whatever topic. You want to talk about or discuss, and people follow you for those very reasons, you know. And I follow people. Most of the people that I follow on Twitter are writers, mm-hmm. and filmmakers, and a lot of those writers and filmmakers do talk politically, and that doesn't bother me because I kind of knew that going in to Twitter that's what it was going to be like, you know. Facebook, however,
by the way,
what's that?
What do you think about that? Like, I was listening to something the other day and somebody said that the reason people get pissed off when public figures talk about politics, especially in the entertainment field, is because entertainment used to be a way to hide from politics, and now we can't get away from it. What do you think about that?
I think honestly, it's just the way that everything has changed so drastically politically, and you know what, the, you know, 2016 election did was just get people so fired up And not that people weren't already, but I think it's just really the what that did, Trump winning, what that did to people's view of our country and just and even their views on what and how us as a country was, you know, was going to be viewed. And I think they just it just really just started a firestorm of, you know, of political interest that may not have already been there for some, and an elevation for, you know, for those that did. So
I think too, what happened was there was a lot of, you know, at the initial phases of, you know, like you said, like for people on the left, this is really like when Trump got elected, this really started to hit home for them. But for people on the right, they were, you know, embroiled in arguments online already over Obama, right? So right. there's a staggering between the left and the right as far as when it began. But it does seem like because social media is new, of course, it has blown up. But it also seems like what happened when it first started was there were people, there were a very vocal minority. And I would say that even still today, the minority is the loud, rude people are still a minority. But there was a vocal minority when these feelings started. And then at a certain point, public figures, if they hadn't said anything, people were making decisions about what they believed based on them not saying anything.
Oh, sure.
You know, like if you were an actress in Hollywood and you never talked about Time's Up or Me Too, then they were making a judgment about what you believed just because you didn't say anything. So right. Then it became right. Like almost like I have to say something just so people know what side I'm on and they don't make the decision for me. And then, you know, like once you start that process, as you know, like just like any argument online, once you get into one, good luck getting away from it.
Oh yeah. I mean, honestly, I got into that sort of discussion. It was maybe earlier this, I think it was earlier this year. It was on Facebook of all places too. And Facebook, I make jokes about Trump, and some of my friends laugh and some of my friends don't really give me shit for it. I'm just making jokes about him. It's a very easy thing to do.
Yeah.
It's not difficult. And I do it for a laugh. And yeah, you know, I'm furious as well. I can't stand this, the fact that he is the president of this country. However, I just do it on Facebook and make jokes and some people laugh and get a kick out of it. That's fine. What I don't do is try and ignite some sort of political discussion. That's not what I use Facebook for. I don't even use Twitter for that, to be honest. It's just, it's not what I do.
I mean, how effective is that anyways? Let's be honest.
It's not at all. Everybody, it's not effective. You're not going to change anybody's mind. If anything, yeah. The only thing you're going to do is change your own mind about your execution on things. Because it's just going to infuriate you. And I got into this, back and forth with a friend of mine because of a comment I made, and maybe foolishly, I'll admit, a comment that I made on her post. And it just turned into this 30 comment between her and I back and forth. This person is an avid Trump supporter. I am not. And I made a comment. There was a clapback and it just turned into this ridiculous conversation where I felt, this person wasn't even just kind of moved way far from the topic we were actually discussing. And right. I wasn't even necessarily at that point, I wasn't even defending myself. I was just basically trying to point out, look, you are arguing the wrong fucking point. This is what I am saying. And you're not understanding this. And it was just dumb. It was just so dumb. And I remember I was at my mom's actually when we were doing this, and my mom, who is not a Trump supporter at all, you know, is sitting there trying to encourage me to stop, to just stop. And I wasn't, and honestly, I tried to be as level-headed as I could. I wasn't attacking at all. And I was mainly just trying to just kind of bring the conversation back to reality. But my mom was just sitting there just in hysterics. And she's like, why do you keep responding? I'm like, I don't know.
it's like a drug, man. It really is. Yeah. You know, like one time I almost did it once with the podcast. I saw something and I was like, it wasn't like I was trying to engage something. I just saw something almost like what you were saying. Like, I'm like, that would be funny. I'm like, but also like, you know, I started typing it and then I had it and I actually think I sent it. And then I looked at it and I'm like, oh, I'm not being funny. I'm trying to be clever. And this is going to, oh wait, no, I don't want this attached to the podcast. I don't want to get into this. Why did I do it? So delete. Luckily, nobody saw it. Luckily.
Yeah.
But it's really easy to do. I mean, that's the whole point of that platform, and especially is you can just fire something off in like 10 seconds without thought.
Yeah. And
that's how it survives.
And I have friends that are very political, and that's fine. It's use it however you want. You know, I may not comment. I may like it, you know, but I'm not going to necessarily get, I don't want to necessarily get involved in a Facebook discussion about it. That's not what I use Facebook for. I use Facebook to connect with friends that I don't see very often and see how they're doing, see how their kids are doing. Twitter, on the other hand, is different. And you can choose to follow, or unfollow people, comment or not, or rant.
Right.
And, you know, I think people who do that on Twitter, you know, they do want to get into a discussion, and sometimes it's, you know, it's an informed discussion and sometimes not, but you know, it's seems less of a, I guess it seems to me ranting on Twitter is, less of a violation than ranting on Facebook.
Right.
You know, but
yeah. But cause you know, there's not as much personal stuff necessarily on most of Twitter. You know, people aren't, here's a picture of me and the kids at the lake. That's not happening a lot on Twitter.
I actually do see some of that actually from a lot of writers actually, which, you know, then, and it's, it, but it, what's interesting is I understand why, you know, and it's just, you know, writers who are just, they're just take, I mean, we're all just a fucking mess, you know? And I like seeing those pictures from writers, cause it's like, okay, they're just taking a break. You know I mean? They're having a struggle. And I have done it too, where I've actually posted a picture of the lake, you know, after having a shitty writing week or even having a good one, but just wanting to take a break and just like, yeah, I'm just, here's my picture. Here's my cool picture of this lake that I'm at. like it or not. But I do see quite a bit of that from writers who post, you know, pics about their, or post pictures of their dogs and kids. And now back to writing, you know, but.
Well, yeah. Speaking of which, we've mentioned so far Twitter. We've mentioned you use Twitter to follow writers. We've mentioned we've mentioned getting back to writing. That's one of the things I want to talk about. But before we can talk about what you referred to as the brutal notes, we want to, like, for everybody who's listening, who listened to the last episode with Mark, like, let's. I think you guys probably want an update on what the writing's going on. What's going on with the writing? If I can say that sentence right.
Yeah. So the last. When we last spoke, I think it was last July, was it maybe?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Okay. I just started. I was in the middle of writing a feature, a new feature length script. I finished that and finished a myriad of rewrites on it, and then I started tooling with some earlier screenplays that I wrote. And then just most recently I finished my first ever 1 hour pilot, which is, was definitely an interesting process and an interesting experience. I've never written a television, or I've never written for television before.
It's very different.
Yeah, it is. It's extremely different. And, this idea, that ended up becoming the pilot was originally meant to be a feature. Just kind of going through the outline, and I had actually started it still with the intent of writing a feature, and just realized that I was like, you know what? I think this would be better as like a limited series, you know, like a 8-episode series on Netflix or Amazon or something.
Right. What and we used to call mini series when we were a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's been so many of those that have been, that have been released, that have been launched. I think in the middle of writing this, I was watching both Russian Doll and Fleabag, which are just both phenomenal. It's just excellent, excellent shows. And, this one is mine is not like those in the sense that, you know, those are comedies. Those are half hour comedies. Mine is a kind of 1-hour sci-fi drama. But I finished that, and while I was kind of doing the revisions for that, I entered the Academy, entered the last feature that I wrote that I finished, the one you and I were talking about. I entered that in a couple of screenplay competitions, one of them being the Academy's Nickel screenplay competition. It's an annual competition that they have. That's probably the most prestigious screenplay competition, and has led to, writers who have not even won, but just placed, you know, made the first or second round, and the quarterfinals or the semifinals round, have led to, you know, them getting represented and them actually being sought after as far as writers. And, didn't even pass the first round in the Nickel. And that was, you know, that was definitely sad and frustrating. And one writer, that I follow on Twitter, I had actually read her script. The nice thing about this writing community that I found on Twitter, and that's really why I love Twitter, is there's just this awesome writing community where everybody is just supporting one another and lifting one another up and offering to do reads of their work in exchange for, you know, them reading other stuff. And if not, just like, hey, I just want to read your script. You know, this script sounds awesome.
Wow.
People will post their log lines. There's writers that are just championing for other writers, you know, writers that are successful that...
Hold on one sec. Can you explain what a log line is?
So a log line is basically it's just a brief, tiny synopsis of your script. So, what you would maybe find on the back of a DVD. You know,
so like almost like an elevator pitch type thing.
Kinda, yeah.
For people who maybe aren't in the same term or a summary.
Yeah. Yeah, so just a brief summary, and there's a writer specifically who is always saying, hey, what's your let's do some Twitter query treats and some spec shout outs or whatever, and it's just basically put your log line in here and we'll share it, you know, just maybe you can get some reads, and it's just really cool. But anyways,
that's really cool.
Yeah, this writer. Just happened to, and I've read quite a few scripts from just this right here, but this writer said, hey, anybody, I'm wanting to submit my screenplay into the Nickel. Do I have any writer friends out there that would be willing to give it a read? And I raised my hand. I said, yeah, I'll do it. So she sent me her script and I read it and really liked it. Gave her some notes, and, the Nickel announcements, you know, I was bummed. I didn't pass the first round, and took a step back and kind of looked at it. And I reached out to her, and, she passed. Actually, she passed the next two. She became a semifinalist, which was awesome. And, so I reached out to her and said, hey, congratulations on making the semifinals. That's terrific. I'm just bummed. Mine didn't even pass the first round. Would you mind reading it? And she agreed, read it. And, the notes weren't good, you know, and, and it was, I mean, the notes were brutal, and these are notes that I wanted to have. As painful as that is, she, you know, before I even sent it to her, she said, what are you looking for? And she used to read, she's a writer's assistant, and she used to be a professional reader. She's been a reader for an executive, and also a contest. So she definitely knows what she's looking for, and she knows what she's supposed to be looking for when reading specs. And she said, you know, what kind of notes are you looking for? Are you just looking for a general overview? Do you want me to be brutal? Are you looking for, you know, just kind of what works, what doesn't, any specific parts? And I just said, yeah, just kind of overall what works, character, structure, dialogue, you know, tone. No need to really, you know, dull the blade, you know what I mean? Just, you know, if you want to stab away, if you feel you need to, and she did, you know, and it was brutal. I mean, it definitely, in the script, the thing that was, I think, the most hurtful were not necessarily her notes, because she wasn't mean in any way. I don't want to give off that impression. I knew exactly what I was getting. I knew exactly what I was getting because that's what I was asking for. And it was just the pure volume of some notes where I thought, you know, you've got to be confident in what you do. I mean, if you're not, then why are you doing it? You know? So I would write something. And yeah, there'd be moments where I'd be like, oh, this is good. I'm proud of this. And it's just the pure volume of some of the notes. And then also how many of them actually made sense when I took a step back and actually looked at it.
And the implications too, right? Where you're like, oh, this doesn't work. Fuck, that's going to create a giant rewrite.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, and something structural, you're like, oh, son of a bitch.
Oh, yeah. and there were definitely some positive notes, you know, that dotted the pages and everything. And that was great. But yeah, you know, you just... It definitely puts things in perspective as far as, and even on a feminist view too, because there were some notes that she gave me where I thought I was actually being very mindful of how my female characters were portrayed, and hearing her notes, you know, did make me consider that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a very hard thing to do when, you know, like to put yourself in the perspective of someone else is the job of a writer, but we're still limited. You know, like you and I have never lived as women.
So right. Yeah.
No matter how sensitive or how we try, we're going to still have blind spots.
Yeah. And I've, you know, tried to be very mindful of that. You know, I've listened to podcasts. There's actually one, which is really funny, called the Bechdel Cast. I just listened to a new podcast. Yes. So yeah. And I listened to a new podcast yesterday where they, reviewed the Fast and the Furious. They don't always do current movies. They'll do movies from, you know, years ago. And they reviewed, their last episode was about, or one of their last episodes was about, you know, the very first Fast and the Furious movie, you know, the franchise. And, you know, I listened to that, podcast quite a bit because it's basically, it's two female comedians and, they just review movies from, you know, through a female lens and basically just review how, women are being treated in those roles. And they'll put it up against, the main point is putting it up against what's called the Bechdel test. And the Bechdel test is basically, you know what that is?
Yeah. So whether two women talk about anything other than men.
Yeah. Yeah. Screen. So two female, there's gotta be at least two female characters who have a name.
That's the other qualification.
Who have names and
not mom.
Have right, and have at least a couple of lines of dialogue where that do not revolve around a man at all.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the bare minimum requirement.
That is, and you would be surprised of how many films do not pass this test.
Oh yeah, you know, I can't remember what I was listening to. Somebody was talking about this, and they said, you know what, surprisingly passes the Bechdel test a lot is Hallmark movies.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
And I imagine maybe they just have a lot more women writers, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Funny story, the Fast and the Furious actually passed.
No shit.
That doesn't necessarily mean they felt it was a good movie by any right.
Right. The car conversation, but, probably.
It was actually a conversation where... Michelle Rodriguez's character, Letty. I don't know. Oh my God. I just listened to this. The guy who plays Dom, I'll just say his character, Dom, is talking to two women. And
is that Vin Diesel.
Fuck.
There we go.
I don't know why.
I've never seen the movie, so I was guessing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an entertaining movie. I mean, they've only gotten more ridiculous, and you know, over the years, there are some that I haven't seen, and just because of what I've seen in the trailers, they've just gone so over the top. But anyway, I think it's when she approaches these two women, she calls them skanks, and then says, "Why don't you take off before I put tread marks on your face?" And one of them says, "Okay," and it was simply because of that that it passed. It says.
Talk about the bare minimum requirement. It's like one knot over the line.
Yeah. And it was just hilarious. But yeah. but my point was just that I thought that I was actually going in, you know, very mindful of my characters. And this is a woman who read my script and clearly did not believe that. So you know, put that, okay, that's something I gotta look at, you know.
It's tough. Especially sometimes for the listeners, sometimes it's not possible to pass the Bechdel test in the sense that, like, for example, the good and the bad, the ugly is never going to pass the Bechdel test because I don't think there's any women in the movie.
Oh, sure. Exactly. Or something like Ocean's 11, which is still, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's that those movies are bad, but I absolutely can, you know, absolutely agree that, you know, that women are not always, represented fairly or accurately.
They're treated like scenery in a lot of films.
In films, yeah. You know, but,
well, there's something they said that, like, so, even if you look at, you know, like crowds that they gather, you know, when they have people just throwing crowds, it's still mostly men. Even when nobody's acting and they're just there to fill space, they still fill it with mostly men. That's strange.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, so there's still, you know, I'm finishing up a rewrite on the pilot, which I'm really excited about. And then there are two other scripts that, you know, that I'm actually looking, the notes that she gave me for this one made me think, okay, let me look at the other scripts too. And just cause there were some very practical notes that she gave me that, I'm like, well, let me, you know what, these I could actually apply to the two earlier ones. And I'm going through and just really just taking a deeper dive into those scripts. And this one that she commented on, the one of the first things that she said, you know, I don't want to harp too much on this, but one of the first things that she said was, look, first off, this is one person's opinion. I know how hard it is. I've been exactly where you are right now.
Right.
You know, I was very, very brutal. And she told me that in the very beginning, before I even looked at the document, before I even looked at the script with her notes written on it, before I even looked at it, you know, she said, look, I was brutal. She's like, I've been here. You know, this is one person's opinion. It doesn't mean I'm wrong. It doesn't mean I'm right. It just, you know, this is what my notes would be, you know, take them how they are or don't. You know, I mean, right. I've given these are exactly the type of notes that I would give a very close friend of mine and, you know, would expect a very close friend to give to me. And sometimes we say, no, fuck off. And it's that. Or sometimes we say, oh, no, you know, you're right. I got to consider that and maybe change a few things up. So, but I'm still proud of it. And I'm definitely not going to toss it. I mean, of course, it's just one person's opinion. And, you know, some of them were very valid. So it's just kind of going back to the drawing board.
It will survive, you know, through brutal criticisms and many, many drafts. Like the things that make it to where we want them to be that end up doing well are the things that can take a beating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say as much as it did kind of beat me down, I'm glad I got him though. I really am, because I ended up writing this Twitter thread about, I didn't call her out by name or anything like that, but I just, you know, and I wasn't even calling her out at all. It was just basically a thread. It was actually in defense of you know, people who do give you notes like that. Cause it was like, right. Look, I was like, I got some brutal fucking notes over the weekend on the last script. And, as much as it sucks to kind of be on the sharp end of notes like that, you know, we've, as writers, you know, we should consider these notes, you know, because here's the thing, any note a fellow writer gives you is worth taking a look at, you know, regardless right. of whether or not you agree with them, you know, it's worth taking a look at. It's worth considering, especially if you have actually read that person's work. And in this right. case, I did. In this case, I did. Yeah. And, yeah. So,
well, I have a friend who's a professional book editor. And when she tells people, she says, I'm always brutal. They're always going to get brutal notes. She says, but remember, my intention is not to destroy you. My intention is to make what you're doing better.
Right.
So I'm never going to tell right. you something that I don't think is going to help you.
Yeah.
It's like putting that hat on, you know, we've all heard, at least in the writing community, have heard, you know, like the writer hat and the editor hat. But then there's also the hat that it takes to receive criticism. And it's a very unique hat. You know, like you touched on it a little bit there, because you have to, number one, you have to go into with two mindsets at the same time. You need to be open, but you also need to be confident. So you need to be able to look at criticism and go, that's valid, that's not, that's valid, that's not. And you need to be able to switch between those two. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but it's easier to do when you know your piece and you know your purpose, your piece, right? Because they say something and you go, okay, yeah, you're right. The reader would not get that. I fucked up there. But then over here, no, that's what you accidentally, you know, like your editor accidentally slipped into writer mode. You know, sometimes people will give you notes on accident, especially if they're a writer, where they're telling you what they would do if they were writing it.
Right.
And those are the ones that you can dismiss. So like, well, you're not writing this. I am. It's just hard to tell the difference between the two. It's a constant switching.
It is. And there definitely were notes in the script where I was like, okay, well, I appreciate that note. I don't agree with that note. And there were some notes where I was like, really? Like, I mean, all right, well, that doesn't really make sense, but okay. And then there were other notes where I was like, fuck, she's spot on here.
Right. You know,
it's funny you mentioned one of the notes, which you just said recently, one of the, on that thread, you know, people were really, responsive to that thread that I wrote. And, you know, one of the notes was actually a writer, super cool guy. I actually read his script last week. Super cool guy. He actually reached out to me privately, and he said, "Hey, thanks for the shout." I gave him a shout out for the script that he wrote on Twitter, and he reached out to me in a personal message and said, "Hey, thanks for the shout out." By the way, he's like, "That's not why I'm reaching out to you. I'm reaching out to you. You obviously hurt from some notes you got." And then he just kind of went into a pep talk and just said, look, you know, you could just step back, take a look at the notes. Are they notes of a writer telling you how they would have written this? Or is it, you know, because if it is, then it's, you know, trust your voice, you know, trust your vision, trust what you want it to do, you know?
And, when it comes to word choice, you know, somebody's telling you like, oh, this word means this to me. Okay. Well, that means that to you.
Yeah. And some were like that. Some were like, huh, I don't understand this. I'm like, well, I actually think it sounds pretty good.
And that's where that confidence has to come in. You're like, no, this is right. You know, like how many times did, you know, like so many great writers, especially the Irish writers, great Irish writers that would do difficult things like Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake is not the kind of book that most people would pick up and go, oh, this is exactly how it should be. It's a fucking difficult book. But he said, this is the way I want to do it.
Yeah. James Joyce wrote that way. You know, I mean, Ulysses is crazy with language. I mean, look at what Anthony Burgess did also with A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I mean, he created his own language, and it was thrilling to read, albeit, you know, hard.
I have a funny story about that.
Let me hear
your sentence. I'll tell you the story after.
No, I remember the first time I read it. I was in my 20s. You know, I was maybe in my early 20s when I first read that book, and it was thrilling to read, but more so because I had never read anything like that. I'm like, God, what the fuck is this guy? This guy is just, this guy has basically created his own language.
Right.
You know, and to have that discipline throughout, or to have that discipline remain throughout the, you know, in entire novel. And it changes here and there. Obviously, when he's with his buddies, you know, the language is more prominent.
Right.
But yeah.
I mean, he'll say hands, but then when he's with his friends, they're rookers, you know?
Right, right. You know?
I was a freshman in college when I read that book. And the funny thing about it is I didn't know there was a glossary in the back. So I read book as a foreign language, basically. I read that whole book figuring out what all the words meant. That's probably why I still remember them. Because I was like, what the fuck is a rooker? What is a rooker?
Yeah.
But then I'd have to look at the context of the sentence. It was a difficult read. And then I got to the end of the book, read the last chapter, and flipped it over like, oh my God, the definition of all the words are right here. I'm such an idiot.
I think I could be wrong, but I thought that Irving Welsh did the same thing with Trainspotting. Mm-hmm. And Trainspotting was a extremely difficult book to read, and I loved it. I really did. Glue is even more so. Glue is almost harder to read than Trainspotting, but Trainspotting was the first Irving Welsh novel that I read, and it's written in a Scottish, you know, accent.
Heavy Scottish, yeah.
Heavy, yeah, heavy. Like
heavier than the movie, actually.
Yeah, and it took me, it took me a long time to finish that book.
Yeah, and everything, for people who haven't seen it, everything in the book is spelled phonetically.
Exactly,
So you know, some words have like three E's and something, you're like, what is that word? It doesn't look like a word I know.
and it was almost like it would be cool when you would, oh, that's it. Like, okay, I got it. And then you started
blush. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then you start to read it a little bit, or it becomes a little bit easier as you're moving along. And so do a lot of his books. And not all of his books are written that way.
It forces you as a reader to become an actor, because once you start figuring out the words, you actually start in your head doing it's probably a bad Scottish accent, but you're doing a Scottish accent in your head.
Yeah.
He's forcing you to act, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't read books out loud at all, but I did find myself doing that with Trainspotting.
You have to, because if you're not doing it the weird phonetic way he's doing it, it doesn't make any sense. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the brilliance of it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going back to the Bechdel test for one second. When I was working on like the novel that I've been working on, that's about the time that I discovered the Bechdel test. And so I said, okay, let's see if my book passes. It doesn't. It doesn't, because kind of similar to what I was saying before, it's impossible for me to, well, not impossible. I would have to add elements to the book simply for the purpose of passing the Bechdel test, which is not a good reason to add elements to a book.
Sure.
So like, for example, there's only probably two scenes in the whole book where two women talk to each other and they talk about a man, because the man's the main character and he's sick. And the only thing these two women have in common is taking care of him. So there's literally nothing else these two people can talk about, nor do I want them to, because they don't like each other.
Right.
So what I had to do for myself is, and I'm glad that I still ran across that term, because what I did is I sat down and I said, what am I doing? Am I, even if I can't give them that kind of conversation, am I still treating them like as genuine characters, or am I stereotyping them? And I had to look and I'm like, you know what? Like, I totally am. This character is totally coming off like a complete, the nagging bitchy wife, which is a terrible stereotype. And it's because, you know, like, the problem I was having was that part of the book was being filtered through the perception of the character, not through my perception, but through the perception of the character, but it's not written in first person. So I had to remember that and separate. So what I did is I actually sat down in every scene and I said, what would she be thinking right now? What would she be feeling? And then once I was able to connect that, oh my God, the scenes got so much better, because they, you know, it's like, oh, this, you know, this shallow argument between two people became something more of a complex conversation where it would go between phases of arguing and then phases of contact, like a real conversation. Yeah. You know, it phased in and out. And so even if you can't, for anybody out there that's a writer, even if you can't pass the Bechdel test because logistically it doesn't fit into the structure, you still deserve to give all of your characters, and this isn't just female characters, you know, your black characters, your white characters, everybody should have the same consideration. Even somebody that's only in a scene for a second and says two things, you should really ask yourself, what is this person thinking and feeling? Because you can enrich your writing so much just by doing that.
Oh, yeah.
That's the biggest lesson that I learned.
Yeah. No, it's an invaluable one. I mean, and I agree. I mean, I'm mindful of that test and really what I've learned from just listening to the podcast, even though a lot of it is, you know, very comedic in nature, it's still really informative, with just, learning, you know, about how women are, you know, represented in film. Right. And, or at least just having that pointed out to you and being able to look at it from a different perspective. But I don't think I don't think that you should write something solely to pass something like that.
Right. You know, like if you're writing a book about a slave ship, you're probably not going to have a lot of Asian characters.
Right.
Because they weren't on slave ships coming from the New World to the Old World. But you don't just write that into the script. So you go, okay, now I have an Asian character.
Right.
That's condescending. That's not, you're not doing any Asian people any favor. You're being condescending. And I think that's a lot of people don't get that, where it's like, you want to be true to the characters you're creating and to who they are. If they're women, be true to their womanhood. If they're black characters, be true to their roots and the just the way you would any other character. And that's how you end up with things like the Bechdel test, because for decades nobody did that. Like, we'll just have a woman here and she says that, and she's like a lamp. She's not a person. They just made a character fill space.
Yeah,
it's fucked up. Yeah, it's an adventure, isn't it? Learning all these things. You think as an adult, you're like, okay, I kind of have some things about life figured out. But then when you're writing or you're pursuing some sort of, I don't even want to say creative adventure, just some sort of project or venture, you find out like, oh no, there's still a shitload of things in the world that I don't know.
Yeah. And I know that regardless of any success that could come, I'm hoping it does, but regardless of any success, I know I'm always going to be learning. I know that I am never going to master this thing to a degree, where my learning is capped. I know that I'm always going to need to learn some things.
It'd be boring if you got to a point where you weren't challenged anymore, wouldn't it?
I know that the things that I write, you know, going back to the drawing board with this particular script, I'm confident that I can, you know, that I can churn this out. I don't want to say relatively quickly, but you know, I obsess over these things. I do. So I'm pretty much working every night. And, you know, I'm staying up late and, you know, I procrastinate. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to make it seem like I'm a fucking machine. No, I mean, I procrastinate just as much as the next guy, but I'm confident that, you know, I'll be able to fix these things and even enhance the things that I don't think should be fixed, you know, maybe just change them up a little. But I know that even the finished product, or what I'll view as the finished product, will probably still get, you know, well, people will still have thoughts on it, and that's fine. That's
good.
Perfectly fine. Yeah.
That's a good thing. If you write something that, you know, you can't write from the perspective of wanting everybody in the world to go, that's perfect. because it means you made something that's neutral, that has no balls, no statement, no meaning. You created, right. You know, you made something vanilla.
And yeah.
You don't want it as a creator. Nobody strives for vanilla. We're trying to make our own flavors.
Exactly. And division is not always a terrible thing. In art, it's not always a terrible thing. I mean, it creates
visual art, right?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it creates conversation. It allows you to look at new perspectives. I mean, the movie, Ari Aster's Midsommar, which came out a couple of months ago. I love that movie, but you know, it definitely divided audiences.
That's the one Brandon was talking about, right?
I believe so.
It's the music festival and that people were tripping on shrooms.
Yeah, not really a music festival. It was a festival that takes place in Sweden every 90 years, but not so much a music festival, but more like a
Burning Man almost.
In a way, but on a more spiritual level. And it's, I mean, there's a lot more to the movie than just that, but, I really love that movie. And I also loved Hereditary, but I know that even Hereditary divided audiences, but that's what made it great. Right. And that's what made Midsommar great. I was listening to a podcast recently where, one of the guys, and it was hosted by three guys, do this podcast about movies, but through the lens of a screenwriter though. So they're really looking at more. So they're talking about the screenplay itself. Obviously they're reviewing the film, but still very much focused on the writing. And one of the main hosts hated this movie, but it was so funny during the podcast episode, he became the one that was defending a lot of the writer's decisions to his buddies. And they're like, what the fuck, dude? They're like, I thought you fucking hated this movie. He's like, I know. I can't believe I'm defending so many things about it. You know, but it just, you know, that's what makes movies like that great. And just not even just movies, but back to the original point, division is not always a bad thing.
Right. You know,
And
what was the name of that podcast? So I can put it in the notes for people.
It was Thundergrunt.
Thundergrunt. Okay. Yeah. I'll look for the Midsommar episode of Thundergrunt.
Yeah. It's a good one. It's a really good one.
Right. Yeah. I think that division in it's really important because you're making a choice. You're making a strong choice. And that's why, you know, like I said, the vanilla thing, there's so many TV shows that the purpose of a television show is to make money and to not offend anyone, not because they care about offending anyone, but because they want to maximize how much money they make. Right. And they're not making a statement. And those are the TV shows that you'll never remember. You know, Whereas you look at the things, you look like Breaking Bad. Come on. Breaking Bad is probably one of the best TV shows ever made. It is not polite. Yeah. It's not a polite show. The Wire, it's not a polite show.
Right. The Shield. I mean, The Shield is... I don't know if you ever saw The Shield. That was on FX.
Chiklis, right?
Chiklis, yeah. Probably my favorite television show ever.
Wow.
I mean, in regard to just the writing, the directing, the performances, the number one thing that stands out to me, and probably why this show, you know, remains my favorite, is the writing. The writing on that show was phenomenal. Just the decision making, in just why characters did things and how they did things. It was all so specific to every character and just really immersive because of that. And Breaking Bad, you know, definitely had that quality as well.
That's how I feel about Homicide: Life on the Street. I don't know if you ever saw that show.
I did not.
That was David Simon before The Wire.
Oh, okay.
And it was just, it unfortunately had bad time slots. It never really got as big as everything else. But like, I think most of the structures of shows like The Shield and obviously The Wire, because it was him, and everything that came after were all influenced by that show.
Yeah.
Because it was, and just like every cop show is influenced by, every serious cop show is influenced by Hill Street Blues, because it was the first ensemble. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you go back and watch that and you're like, oh, this is rough. This isn't rough, you know, but for the time that was a divisive show.
Yeah. And because of, and you know, you bring up Breaking Bad, you know, you have an anti-hero who, you know, I'll admit it. I rooted for the guy. I mean, he was terrible. He was a terrible person, but I rooted for him.
Well, that's the power of that show. Like, yeah. It gets you to root for him and then slowly regret it over time.
Right.
So where you start getting nauseated.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully, you know, people have seen the show. I'm not going to go into huge spoilers, but, you know, when the show ended, I was like, okay, yeah, he deserved that.
That's the way it should have ended.
Yeah.
And, it couldn't have ended any other way.
Yeah, and even, you know, Michael Chiklis's character in The Shield, Vic Mackey, he was a despicable person, you know, and just the depths that he would go to protect. I mean, he was doing it obviously to protect his team and his family, but I mean, he was just doing these horrific things. I rooted for him too.
That's good writing.
When he got away with things, I was like, fuck yeah. You know, you're fucking smart.
Yeah. You know, isn't that the weirdest thing about dramas, especially police dramas on television? Even like, not even taking it to the extreme of rooting for characters like that, even your average like NCIS or CSI, well, maybe CSI didn't do this, but NCIS or Law and Order, you get used to watching these cops do things that if they did them in real life, we would be appalled by. But on television, we're rooting for them, you know, like beating a suspect or, you know, tricking a suspect in, you know, into some kind of subterfuge. And you're going, oh, yeah, they got him. Good. But then if you saw a news story where a cop had did that, you'd be outraged.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe we have police that do things like this. It's a really weird situation we've set up there. I don't understand it.
It is. It seems to have characters like that, though, you know, and maybe I'm just not watching those shows or I haven't watched those shows. Characters like that, though, feel like they have not so much vanished, but aren't being really written anymore. Or actually, I don't even want to say that. Maybe I'm just not seeing those shows.
You know? Well, I think what's happened is what used to be is, you know, used to be like the tough guy, you know, like, it was like the Dirty Harry is a great example, not TV, but Dirty Harry. Dirty Harry did despicable things. You know, like he killed people without even having proof that they were guilty. Which is not good in real life, but it's become watered down. Like I don't watch a lot of what's on television right now, but like I still catch it when it comes on to streaming. I like cop shows. So I end up watching a lot of them, even crappy ones. Or maybe not even crappy, but just kind of like average ones, like the new version of Hawaii 5-0. I like it. It's all right. It's entertaining. I'm not seriously psyched about it. But you know, when I want something that's kind of entertaining, but I don't want to be super engaged with it, it's great. But even on the shows like that, they do things where it's like, okay, what you're doing right there is violating that person's rights. But in the context of this show, it's cool because you're trying to catch that guy. And I think what it is on shows like that is we're freed from having to worry about whether the cop is violating the law, because in the context of fiction, we know that person's guilty.
Right.
So we can excuse anything they do to catch that person because we as the audience have the benefit of knowing that person's guilty. But in real life, we don't have that benefit. So maybe, I don't know. I've never thought about that before. It came out of my mouth right now. So maybe that's what it is. I don't know.
Because it's just the consequences are completely removed when you like a thing like that, like a roller coaster. You know, you can have that thrilling feeling without any of the consequences at all.
Right.
You know, you can be dropped from, you know, this high. You could be dropped from this, you know, really high level, but you know you're going to be okay.
Right. Exactly.
But it's still really scary though.
Yeah. That cop. That cop is not, he's not patrolling your neighborhood. He's not breaking into your house. He's a fictional character. It's okay.
Yeah. but if a character that I think the reason why I liked, a character like Vic Mackey or, Walter White is because even though they were doing these horrible things, there was still, there was still the matter of family. There was still the matter of friendship, or anything, I mean, Walter White protected. Complexity. Yeah, exactly. There was still that complexity that I could relate to, not relate obviously to the heinous acts, but still relate to in some way. If I just saw a show about a cop who just goes out on patrol and just randomly or pulls a black man over and just starts beating him or kills him, and that's supposed to be the main character, oh, I'm tuning out of that. I don't want to watch that
like,
shit
what
at
is
all.
This show?
Yeah, it's like, I should care about this fucking guy, And so, I mean, now I'm saying that, any SHIELD fan, knows what Vic Mackey does very early on in the first episode. So, all right.
Or anybody that watched the Harvey Keitel movie, The Bad Lieutenant.
Oh yeah, where he pulls those young women over and
pulls something else out too.
Yeah.
Everybody should watch that. Be offended.
Yeah, I can't say that I liked that character at all or had any sympathy for that guy. But it was a fascinating movie, though. It really was.
Well, the thing about fiction and complexity is it's compelling. The complexity is compelling. When everything is simplistic, it's boring because it's predictable.
Right.
That's why I thought one of the things that the Marvel Netflix shows did really well wasn't the heroes. The heroes, in all honesty, weren't that interesting. It was the villains that compelled those shows. Now, the first season of Daredevil was good because Vincent D'Onofrio as the Kingpin was amazing. And he was complex, and you liked him, but you hated him. And David Tennant in the first season of Jessica Jones as Killjoy, he's disgusting, but also completely charming and compelling. And that complexity drives things. And it's easy, these TV people we're talking about that worry about, like making these vanilla shows that make as much money, they don't inject very much complexity because they don't want the consequences, which is the division, going back to where we started with all this. But that's what makes things interesting and what makes them last in our heads. The books that we don't like stick with us just as much as the books that we really like. But it's the ones that we have no opinion on that we forget. Like, what did you think of that book?
I mean, there's even music like that too. I mean, there's music that I can listen to while I'm just doing dishes, and it's, and it's soothing. It's a soothing thing to do while I'm doing, or it's just music that I don't really have to pay attention to, And then there's music that totally pulls me in that I can't do anything while listening to it, or I'm unless it's exercise. Exercise is different. I think you could listen to anything while exercising.
Yeah.
But when
you're washing the dishes, you can put on some samba or something. You're like, I'm not paying attention. But then Sonic Youth, you got to pay attention.
Right. Yeah. Joy Division. Yeah. I'm not going to listen to Joy Division while I'm, cleaning my floor or
clipping your toenails.
Or who knows? Maybe I would. I don't know. Maybe I have, actually.
Makes it better. Maybe we're doing it all wrong, Mark.
Yeah, no kidding. But there's music that's just elevator music, and there's quite a bit of it nowadays.
I don't even know. I was just flipping through something the other day. I think it was Apple News, and I saw something. I don't know why I clicked on it, but it was like Taylor Swift covers Phil Collins. As far as I know, I've never heard Taylor Swift. And I say as far as I know is because it's quite possible I've walked into stores where she's playing and I don't know it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with Beyonce. Like, I couldn't tell you. And it's not because I'm avoiding them. It's just like I'm not in the realm where that kind of music, pop music, comes at me. At least not in a way for me to know what I'm hearing. But for some reason, I clicked on this thing and she covers this Phil Collins song. And I'm like, okay, I get why this girl's famous. She's beautiful. I knew that. But she has an amazing voice. And it was weird because I'm probably like fucking 20 years behind on that knowledge. But listening to the thing, I was like, okay, I get why you're famous. You have a very good voice. Awesome.
Yeah.
But I'm.
What's interesting, well, I used to work at T-Mobile, and I used to manage the some of the stores and some of the teams. My most recent one was managing the Oak Ridge team in the store in Oak Ridge Mall, and obviously a job like that, and a retail job like that, you're listening to music constantly, and you're listening to top 40 stuff, and so I was exposed to all of that, me being a big music guy, I had my opinions. I mean, I know what I like and I know what I don't, and I know why. And listening to, I hear Taylor Swift, that song, Shake It Off, I think is one of the, she's got a lot of popular songs, but that one was really big. And listening to that song, I'm like, okay, I don't like this song. I would never listen to this song on my own, but I could see why people like this song.
Right.
I could see why because it's just fun. It's just it's just fun music, and people, that's fine. People like music. I like listening to Radiohead. I like listening to music that, makes me feel a certain way.
Right.
Some people like doing that. Other people like just listening to music that's fun. And that's awesome. because I do it too. I don't listen to, I don't listen to Radiohead every day of my life. There's some times where I'm like, no, I don't want to listen to this album. I don't want to listen to Tom York sing right now. I'm going to listen to, Angel Olsen, or I want to listen to PJ Harvey or somebody else. So, but I was very, I was exposed to a lot of that, Beyonce and all that stuff, and I can see why people like it, and I can see why it's popular, and why it's the focal point of a lot of TV shows and movies, and why it's there, and music.
It's a very different phase of things, like it's like two different, something I've probably brought up with at least three guests is there's like two different music worlds. There's the I'm hesitant to use the word because it have the connotations, but art music world. And then there's the popular music view, and the popular music is, like you said, it's just to elevate the mood of whatever you're doing. I'm listening to this while I'm driving the car and I'm not really paying attention, but it's a nice day to drive in my car. And this music helps to elevate that a little bit. And then the art music is like you said, I want to feel something. I want to explore something. And, it's exploring emotions, exploring ideas, exploring sounds, going back to Sonic Youth.
Right.
And so two different purposes and two different audiences. And you and I just don't happen to be pop audiences. And I don't know. Well, I guess maybe that's, I was going to say, I don't know many men who are, but that's not true because there is like top 40 for men. And I think right now it tends to be more hip hop and R&B.
Yeah.
Another thing I don't know a ton about.
Yeah. I like pop music. I don't necessarily like top 40 style pop music. But I like 80s pop. I do like, yeah, exactly. I'll still listen to the shit out of Love and Rockets or something like that. I'll still listen to a lot of that stuff nowadays and still feel, it's interesting when you made me think of a band, but when you were talking about, bands that, have been more considered in the past maybe, or I'm sorry, just the whole kind of art music and pop music. It's interesting, listening to Sleater-Kinney's latest album, because they made a very, very noticeable shift from, the music that they, you know, the music that they were known for, you know, to a very, very, to me anyway, top 40 sounding album.
Right. With, the drummer left over the change. With,
yeah. So, the album's called The Center Won't Hold. And the interesting thing was, is St. Vincent, or Annie Clark, AKA St. Vincent. She is, an extraordinary musician. She's incredible. When it was announced that she was producing their album, I got excited. I was like, holy shit. I mean, that is a fucking collaboration if I've ever thought of, you know, fucking St. Vincent and Sleater-Kinney. Yes, I'm in. And then news broke a couple of months ago that Janet Weiss was leaving the band. Very openly, because of the direction of the that they were going in,
right?
And that made me a little nervous. I was like, "Oh shit!" Well, I'm going to listen to the album. Fuck yeah! And you know, I mean, but that made me a little nervous, though. You know, because Janet Weiss was, I mean, it's, you know, one of the, you know, most energetic and just impressive drummers, iconic drummers. You know, the past 20 years. But I was like, oh God, what does this thing sound like? You know? And St. Vincent's albums, you know, they definitely have a very different sound. So I said, okay, well, and I didn't think about that at first, you know, when I was like, okay, I didn't know what kind of influence, you know, she was going to have, on the band. But I was excited, you know, to listen to the collaboration. Anyway, the album comes out and I'm like, okay, now not assuming I know exactly what was going on, you know, Janet Weiss's head, you know, what she thinks about, but yeah, it's, I don't want to bash. I don't want to sit there. I'm not here to trash the album or anything. You know, I wasn't a fan of the album. I listened to it, I think, 4 times. I said, you know what? I listened to it once and developed an opinion about it. They deserve more than that.
Right.
But I did not like it the first time I listened to it. And I had listened to some of the singles, you know, before the album came out. And I said, ha, okay.
So did
what
I.
Is this album, what is this album going to sound like? You know?
It's like gothy and, pop almost.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And, you know, it's still, there's a lot of things that the album is missing, you know, that the last album, the last album, No Cities to Love, I think, you know, came out like 3 or 4 years ago. That actually was my very first Sleater-Kinney album that I ever owned.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And I loved that album. And then I went back, you know, and, you know, One Beat, I think, is my favorite. One Beat's my favorite album, but
Hot Rocks is mine.
Hot Rocks is a great one too. Yeah, The Woods is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're Call the Doctor is the only one that I don't think I've heard. But so I went, you know, I was like, oh God, these fucking women are fucking awesome, and then I listened to this album. I listened to it on the airplane when we went to Illinois, when Josephine and I went to Illinois. I listened to it in, you know, in Pennsylvania when we were there, and just in our in the hotel room, you know, after going out. And yeah, I couldn't get into it. I just couldn't do it. And I started thinking more about, you know, the collaboration. I'm like, I don't know.
Cat Power did that. Like, Cat Power had one album where it was like popular, and I was like, doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So,
you know. And she's actually, is it Sean Marshall? Is that her name? Is that
you? Yeah.
I only have one of her albums, and it's the Greatest. And I don't know if that's the one you're referring to.
The Greatest is actually a really good album.
Yeah, it is.
The one after it is called Sun that I'm thinking of.
Yeah. But
yeah, if you go back, you should go back and definitely check out the Covers record, because her cover of The Stones is the most unique cover of the Rolling Stones. She covers Satisfaction, and it's like a completely different song. It's so cool. Yeah.
But it's interesting that a lot of bands take that, a lot of bands make that, that shift from, you know, from whether it's, you know, post-punk or punk or even just rock to very synthy to synth pop, you know, and it's a very common shift. And I don't know why, because it's not the most interesting, it's not the most interesting turn. And not that synth music in any way is, you know, easy to make, you know, I mean, it's difficult to make that sound good at times or interesting or unique, but I've seen a lot of bands, you know, take that approach.
You know, the Killers did it. But sometimes it works, you know, like Arcade Fire did it and it was great. Sometimes it doesn't.
You know, are you referring to what was their last album?
Reflector. Reflector was synthy as well, though. Too. Reflector was before it.
Reflector was, and I liked Reflector. I think the new one was Everything Now.
Yeah.
And I did not like that album at all.
Yeah, the songwriting.
And it was because of that, though. And Reflector, see, you could definitely tell that they were, because even, is it Funeral? Is that the name of their first album?
Yeah.
Even Funeral, you know, they're very, like, towards the end of the album, you know, or, you know, they get into a more pop oriented, you know, love or stage or whatever. And then Neon Bible definitely had that. So you kind of knew already where they were going.
Yeah. And the Suburbs did too. It's harder to notice because it's guitar driven, but there's synths underneath every song on the Suburbs.
Oh yeah. And that might be my favorite album of theirs is Mine the Suburbs. Too, yeah. The Suburbs is great. And then Reflector came out. That was good too. That was actually more Reflector. You could definitely hear more reggae influence.
And disco
which
too.
Which you definitely hear in Anything Now or Everything Now. And I just couldn't do it. I listened to that album and I felt the same way. Very similar take on Everything Now that I did The Center Won't Hold by Sleater-Kinney. Very same. And I gave it a couple of listens. I listened to that album maybe three times. I'm like, no, it's not sinking. You know, maybe a year from now, maybe it'll do it.
I love that. When you're like, I never liked this album. Now all of a sudden I love it.
Yeah.
What's funny is we brought the conversation in a full circle right now too. You know, you realize that, right? That we started talking about putting out stuff and it's about the process. Just keep putting stuff out. It's about the process.
Yeah.
That's probably what they're thinking. Like, hey, let's try it. Why not? We never got to work with her before. And who knows?
And I don't, of course. Yeah. And I don't begrudge a band for wanting to do something that they've never done before. I mean, absolutely not.
Otherwise,
if Radiohead wanted to make a synth album, that would very much surprise me if they ever did that. But if they did,
kind of a synth album, right?
What's that?
Kid A's kind of a synth album.
I think that's more of an electronic.
Yeah, that's a good point.
An electronic album, very experimental. And good. But if they did, I mean, if Thom Yorke did, you know, I loved his last album, his Anima.
Every album doesn't have to be our favorite to still support the band, you know.
Like
we said, you know, go through Arcade Fire. Do I like Arcade Fire? Yes. Do I love every album and want to play it all the time? No. Just like the National. I love the National. Their last two albums, I don't like as much as Trouble Will Find Me.
Yeah.
But...
I was not a fan of... I was absolutely not a fan of the last album.
The one with all the female singers?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very different.
It is very different. And, you know, I definitely like guest vocals. I do. Be it, you know, man or woman, I don't care. I like guest vocals. They really had a lot of it. I was like, God, this doesn't even sound like National anymore. It just sounds like a completely different band. And some bands, Matt Berenger, I think is his name. I don't know. I some songs I was like, wait, has he even sung yet?
when you find out the story behind that album, though, is it started out just to be one song. And God, what's the guy's name? He has the same Mike Mills, not the bass player from REM, but the filmmaker Mike Mills wanted to do.
Oh, okay.
He wanted to do a film project, and so they're just going to do one song. And he's like, "Can I produce? I've never produced music before." And they're like, "Sure, why not?" And yeah. So they brought this dude who has no experience producing music in, and they just had fun making the song. And they're like, "Well, shit, let's just do a whole album like this." And that's why they did it, just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
So the story is really cool. Like, I'm, you know, like it's like a 7 out of 10. It's not a bad album. Yeah. I'm just not excited about it.
Yeah, I would even rate it lower. I mean, I listened to it. I listened to it a couple of times. I think the first time I was like, I'm bored. I can't even finish this whole thing. I'm just bored. And like Sleater-Kinney, that new album I didn't like, but it's interesting though.
Right.
You know, I was like, okay, I want to hear the next song. Okay. All right. I wasn't crazy. Yeah, I wasn't crazy about that song, but that fucking guitar riff right there was pretty cool though.
You know, I was so listening to the new Tool album yesterday, and I found myself spacing out. And I'm like, "Am I too old for Tool now? Like, is this boring?" I'm like, because that little repetitive drum and guitar thing—they've been doing that for like 2.5 minutes with nothing changing.
Yeah. Somebody on Twitter, said, I think they said, "I'm listening to the new Tool album. It sounds like followed by ellipses." Tool. There's such a stupid
I'm like, why are you doing
joke, that for but it was so funny. Long? Yeah,
but you know, first listen, so I can't really judge it. Who knows, like you said. Yeah. And I gotta give it at least like 3 or 4 more listens. I might fall in love with it. I might have been in a bad mood, just like I say with books. If you don't like a book, you should probably reread it at some point later in your life. Obviously if it's a decent book, you know, like a piece of, you know, some biography by somebody you don't care about, you're probably never going to care about that. But
yeah, I was just going to say about Tool, they were one of those bands that I listened to when I was actually in my transitional period of just learning what the fuck I was really excited about, you know, music wise, you know. And I really liked Undertow. I really liked that, which, you know, everybody did, but it's cliche to even mention the video for Sober, you know. I really liked that album. Was great. And that that kind of secret song at the end with the in the slaughterhouse, at least, just freaked me out. But that was it. That was the last album I listened to of theirs. And it wasn't big, and I love that album. I just started listening to other stuff, and it just it was just a huge shift in what I was listening to and what was really kind of connecting. And yeah, they were just one of those bands that I still have respect for, but I don't even know their full catalog in any way.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to carry this conversation on over to Patreon because we're still hot. We're going to keep going. Okay. So if you guys want to listen to the rest of our conversation, the bonus episode, we'll call it, you guys can go over to patreon.com/holyfoolproductions, become a patron, $5 or more. You have access to bonus content, like who knows how long we're going to go for. I have a feeling we're going to go for a while because there's so many more topics I want to talk about with you.
And do that Patreon, because this next part's going to get really dirty.
So. Oh yeah, we're gonna pull out all the stops. where can everybody follow you online? Where do you want to direct them to?
My website is themadshot.com. www.themadshot.com. So that's where you can you can see my photography. I haven't actually uploaded too many new pictures over the past year or so. But you could still take a look at, there's a variety of different, you know, categories you could look at. And you could also read my blog. The blog too, I've only written, I think this year I've written maybe 3 new blogs. But the blog was always something that I did every couple of months, right. even less so now, since I've just really been focusing on the screenwriting, but still very much wanting to contribute, another blog to the site soon.
And if you guys haven't listened to the last episode with Mark, make sure you go back and listen to that one. We talked a lot about the blog, and I highly recommend you guys go read the blog. I love it. So, and if you guys want to follow Random Badassery on Twitter or Instagram, We are at Random Badass Radio, all one word. You can follow us there. And if you dug this episode and you're listening in Overcast, like right now, give it a star. Share this episode with somebody. That's a really cool thing to do. I would appreciate it. More people, especially if anybody that's out there is a writer, this would be a great episode for them to listen to. And then, of course, take the time, go on Apple Podcasts, rate and review us. And before we end this section of the conversation, Mark, do you have words of wisdom that you would like to end with for the audience?
Sure. So just kind of going back to what I said about, you know, the notes that I got. Trust, you know, just kind of echoing what that, you know, what my a fellow writer, you know, said to me. Trust your voice, and trust what you want to do. That doesn't mean, you know, denouncing notes that you get. You know, if you're a screenwriter like myself, you're going to get them. But take a step back and look at them. But regardless of whether or not you agree with those notes, respect what they're suggesting, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you should forget about your voice and forget what you, you know, were hoping to put out there. Write the movie you want to write, make the music you want to make, and just trust your voice.